Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Over the past 2 years, a series of police shootings and deaths while in custody that began with the choking death of Eric Garner in New York and the shooting death of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri in the summer of 2014, and has continued on and off over the last 2 years, most recently with the shootings of Alton Sterling and Philando Castile, and the tragic police shootings in Dallas and Baton Rouge, has made it impossible to not acknowledge the breach of trust between police and sections of the communities they serve. Beyond the protests, communities around the country and here in Tulsa are initiating dialogue to look at police procedures and ways to rebuild the level of trust some have said have never been present in their communities. My guest today has long been an advocate for a style of policing that its proponents say does alleviate much of the tension between police and the communities they serve and reduces the level of everyday confrontation between the police officers and members of the public. Former Tulsa Police Chief Drew Diamond may have left the Tulsa Police Department in 1991, but he remains a nationally known advocate for community policing. And he joins us today to talk about the ways communities and police can build better ties between them while maintaining safe communities for the public as well as the police. Drew Diamond, welcome back to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
It's always a pleasure, Rich, to be with you.
Even though you've retired from the Tulsa Police many years ago, 25 years, you have been involved in community policing and advocating community policing ever since. And I want to just ask you, given the events of the past several weeks where we had two separate shootings of black men by police and then two separate shootings of police by a gunman, a lot of people are just wondering, where are we going in policing in the United States now? And, you know, the relationship between communities, especially in African-American community, as well as other minority communities and the police. What can the police do to sort of repair this relationship?
Well, I think the first thing to do in terms of this discussion is to understand that it is complex. It's been going on for decades. And the sense of policing, I mean, the term you used it, the term of community policing, which has been with us for almost a little over 30 years. You know, I was at the beginning of that while I was police chief here and developing it here and nationally. It's misunderstood, and we'll talk about that if you want in a few minutes. But I think in terms of what's happening today, we're a society in which actually crime is down. The 900,000 plus men and women in policing do more than a great job, an outstanding job. On the fringes of that, in that number of people, are people who don't do a great job, who are not properly trained, not properly supervised sometimes, or just, you know, aberrations in terms of the dealing. But underlying that, particularly about race in this country, is racially biased behavior. 15 years ago, I co-authored a book called Racially Biased Policing, A Principled Response. And of course, as we looked at the police behavior and the disparate impact of the way arrests are carried out around race, and which includes disparate, you know, sentencing, disparate problems throughout the criminal justice system, it's not arguable, certainly not with me and the researchers nationally and all of us who do this, that that's a problem. Minority communities understand it, particularly the black and Hispanic communities understand that. What they don't understand sometimes is how policing in this country can still find it arguable about the level of that behavior inside what we do. And police officers, can, like other human beings, can do this without really knowing that they're doing it. You know, it's driving while black, driving while brown. It is a behavior that police fall into. You know, we saw it in Ferguson. I mean, Ferguson, sadly, was a textbook example of a police department that was using its power, particularly against minority community, the black community, to raise revenue. Yeah. They were destroying lives along the way. It's not only illegal and improper, it is immoral, you know. And you add to that, though, the level of what's changed these days, the level of firearms and weapons in everybody's hands, including criminals, and the danger for police is escalating because of that proliferation of weapons, particularly assault-type weapons and high-caliber weapons. And this, you know, so the police and the community share the sense of being victimized. You know, on every given day in this country, 35 to 38 people will be murdered while today.
Right.
You know, and we've got serious issues.
Following up on that, at the same time, we have laws now, open carry laws, that anytime a policeman makes a stop or stops somebody either on the sidewalk or on a car, they don't know what they're approaching. I mean, compared to 30 years ago, the idea of a weapon in the car was perhaps the outlier, not maybe increasingly the norm.
Well, we've now made it erroneously so, a sense of, you know, the Second Amendment constitutional rights. The Second Amendment, all the court cases, everything, does not give anybody the unfettered right to have any kind of weapon they want anywhere they want it. Politically, we have people who politically want it to be that way, this state included, you know. And it's the same people, as they fight for arming everybody, cry, and I think crocodile tears sometimes when our police officers get shot or killed, you know, they do that as if they have no hand in the sense of the violence, particularly around firearms and access to firearms that exist. You can't separate the two things. Police officers today, because of the undoing of the assault weapons ban and the inability to manage and control the sale of firearms, you know, it's not a cure-all in terms of gun safety and gun regulation, but we know it helped, and it saved lives, including police lives. So now, though, for this ideological sense of the Second Amendment and how we do this politically, we're willing to risk not only the community, but we're willing to risk police officers. And you're seeing that today.
Let me ask you about, I was reading one study which looked at a lot of the confrontations come from, and he termed it as the borderlands. Because even though we have a racially pluralistic society, we're still oftentimes segregated by where we live and our communities. And it's these borderlands between different socioeconomic groups and racial groups a lot of times where a lot of these confrontations happen.
Well, that's correct. And Tulsa is a good example of a racially divided city, has been for decades. And the sense of it is it works this way. You know, whether it's North Tulsa, I've lived in my little house at 31st and Garnett, you know, for 45 years. But when I tell people, they say, where do you live? And I say, I live at 31st and Garnett. And they say, oh, you live in the barrio. Yeah. Because now, you know, East Tulsa is, you know, has gotten that.
It's
and
strange.
It's not said pleasantly. It's said with a nasty connotation. Or you live in North Tulsa. You know, how can you live up there or go there? How can you go to East Tulsa? I mean, this is a conversation that hasn't changed, sadly, in this community. We've done a little better, but not much. And what the police fall into the trap of doing something we've called policing from the perimeter, where they drive around, going from call to call to call, but they drive around outside the neighborhoods on the main roads and the main highways, waiting for the bad thing to happen. Then they rush in, the Tulsa Police Department certainly is a well-trained, well-educated, you know, police department. They'll rush in and they'll clean up the problem for the moment, and then when they're done, they leave. They have very little sense of the environment, the neighborhoods. You know, you ask most people in this city, and they will tell you. You know, you say, and cities like us, you say, well, what do you know about the police? Who's your neighborhood police officer? You know, who's assigned out here, and what do they know about you? Unless you've been arrested by them, or they made a couple calls to your house for something, that's all they know. So getting a sense of redesigning community policing, by the way, is organizational transformation. It actually redesigns the police department around one basic premise, that the main function of policing in our democracy is carried out by uniformed officers in the neighborhoods that they're assigned. That's the function. Everything else is just support for that officer out there. And what's happened is we've gotten out of balance. We're now over-specialized. We've got everybody in warrants units, gang units, high-impact units, everybody running around in some police departments, including ours, in battle dress uniforms, you know, doing special stuff. And it thins out the ability to actually do the prevention. And so you have to grow those units and grow the detective division, as particularly as property crimes, interesting enough, and things get worse, you know, in a city. And so it removes the ability of the police department to do the community level, neighborhood level prevention that it's designed to do, that the officers are trained to do. That's what they're supposed to do. So in that transformation, though, you have to train the officers and the community on basic problem-solving skills. That's part of the community policing transformation. There's actually a well-worn and well-worked model called the problem-solving model for police that are using it all over the country and all over the world, as a matter of fact, to engage the community. And then in that is a community engagement. All problems and all policing are absolutely local. They're street level. You know, if the message is, and communities that don't do community policing and departments that don't do it and reject it, they say a few things, Rich. They'll say, we don't have enough officers. It has nothing to do with the amount of officers you have. This is an organizational design and transformation. It's never been a stopper for police departments that do this. We don't have enough money. It doesn't cost any more money. It's about the resources you have and about how you train them and deploy
them. Allocating resources.
Yeah, how you allocate them. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's the officers won't like it. I had the privilege of training the entire Dallas area rapid transit police, you know, one of their officers who was in that 8 years ago in community policing. One of their officers died. They're fully committed. We trained the entire police department from the chief down to the maintenance staff on this model, and they do it well. Dallas Police Department, which decades ago couldn't community police itself out of a wet paper bag, has come a long way. But the resistance, particularly from some of the officers sometimes, is resistance to change, resistance to being put back into direct field contact. You know, we have come to value the support mechanisms over the actual patrol operations. So these can be difficult changes.
And when the difficult changes, as you describe them, it's different because a lot of times we're talking life and death situations from time to time, but it's not much different than a workplace where you have to collaborate and you have to, you know, that's sometimes harder than going to your office.
There's safety. We know that there's safety in collaboration. There's safety in knowing each other. Respect and trust are built out of engagement with
honest
each other.
Interactions,
honest interaction. And also transparency and oversight in democratic policing principles are built around that. But if the beat officers, and by the way, this is a design that police departments around the country actually use, where you stabilize officers over the whole 24-hour period in a beat for 3 or 4 years at a time at a minimum, and they work the same beats, the same shift, and they have part of their responsibilities is in between calls. One of the myths is, by the way, we're running from call to call to call. We don't have time to do this. That's mythical, by the way. There are moments when you're running from call to call to call, but we've never found a police agency, an urban police department, that did not have the space and the time to do what I'm about to say, which is then to get to understand and know who's in that neighborhood. Who in your neighborhood gets Meals on Wheels? Who's homebound? Which children are vulnerable in that neighborhood? You know, what is it about the kids, you know, who are out there on the street? What do you know about them? Do you know who their families are? What are the businesses around it that support that neighborhood? You know, and this is vital to officer safety. The more an officer knows about the environment in which he's policing, he or she are policing in, the safer they are. When they go to a call, because people know them, they know people, they're less likely to get to make a mistake. They're less likely to panic, you know, in terms, because fear of the unknown is what causes you to stand back and sometimes make a terrible mistake.
Yeah. My guest today is Drew Diamond. He's the executive director of the Jewish Federation of Tulsa. He's a former Tulsa police chief and a community policing advocate. And he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. So we talk about just the events of the last couple of weeks involving police shootings and the shooting of police by gunmen. I want to ask you about one thing. You were saying, you know, crime statistics are going down, but the perception still, and a lot of times it's demagogic politicians sort of making a case that the perception is that it's way up. And certainly we might have had a little spike over the last year, but the overall timeline is, you know, the statistic line is going downward. How does that perception impact the police as far as how they allocate resources? Does it make a difference? I mean, you're talking about the task
force. In the community, it does. Our tendency is to take on crimes by task force. yes. when opposed to taking on crimes. Listen, we know neighborhoods, you know, a lot of people in our neighborhoods in, here in Tulsa and other cities won't feel that crime is going down because they're having with the crime that affects them on a regular basis is theft and vandalism and you know, and those kind of things, which are more than an annoyance. Those are serious things. And when you're violated, you're violated, you know, and the sense of dealing with that. The tendency is for the police to wait until there's a lot of that going on, then form some kind of task force and try to do something about it, when the prevention is actually on the ground from the beginning with the officer that's on that beat and the officers in that squad and the supervisors in that squad on the beat. They should know from the beginning if they have, all of a sudden we've had two break-ins, you know, in a row here. Most of the neighborhood break-ins and things are done by people who live within walking or short driving distance of the neighborhood, you know. But if you don't know the neighborhood or you're not familiar with it, or you have to wait for some 6 months later an analysis that says, by the way, you had 20 of these things, that officer should know it up front. He would know that, he or she would know that, if they were fully engaged in the problem solving within that neighborhood and be able to work out a plan to deal with it. Police departments that have done that successfully, I'll give you an example, is Anaheim, California. For the last 25 years, Anaheim has been committed to not only community policing, but the development of community governance out of that. It's a city of 400,000. It's smaller geographically than Tulsa. It's got about 35 square miles. We've got 180. But it has 2 million more people in, you know, around Disneyland and the Ducks and all those things in the metropolitan area. You know, it's Southern California. They have, sadly, Tulsa right now is in the top 3 percentile in violent crime index of cities. Anaheim's in the bottom 3%. We have 790 police officers. Anaheim has 420. I think they added 4 positions to the police department in the last 20 years. Their neighborhood design, their beat design, their relationships from their officers and the people in that neighborhood, their weekly and meetings in terms of engagements, with, you know, I helped with that design in the first 10 years of it. The entire city government is committed to that. That's the way they govern, whether it's potholes in the street or crime or vandalism or murders. They are engaged. They all know who from the city represents the city and the government in that. And there's a high level of trust. Anaheim, California. So they get 70% less violent crime with half the cost.
I know it's a very ethnically diverse city.
Absolutely.
But does it have the socioeconomic disparities?
It did, and it does. And it is now one of the few cities in Orange County in Southern California that can tout itself as gang-free. They weren't 25 years ago.
Right.
You know, and think what surrounds them. I mean, they're a suburb of Los Angeles, I mean, in terms of doing this. But it's not only the models are out there. San Diego is one of the largest committed to community policing and problem solving for the last 25 years. You can look at San Diego. You can look at Fort Worth, Texas. You can now look at most of the police departments in North Texas, including DART, including the Dallas Police Department now, but certainly Irving and Plano and those cities. Those are all community policing cities. You can look at there's cities in Colorado like Longmont and Madison, Wisconsin, Portland, Oregon, which is similar, same size as Tulsa. You know what we found in our research that we did nationally is how these cities are being so successful and driving down the national crime numbers. Ours may be up at times, but those numbers in those cities go down is because over the last 20 years, it's not only been the police leadership and the police chiefs. It's been the mayors and city managers have, no matter what party, no matter what political, they have been committed to this transformation, and their racial problems go. You know, it doesn't all disappear, but it certainly softens and goes by the wayside. It doesn't become the issue of the day that drives all the action.
Well, let me talk about next steps for a community like Tulsa. There have been some conversations between some community leaders and representatives of police in which. There have been some talking, but it's like each side is talking and maybe the other side is not listening to what they're saying or even hearing what they're saying about the real belief that there are racial disparities in how police are policing and from the police side, their own concerns. So how do we get beyond just talking at each other to actually sort of the first steps?
The first step is for the political leadership of this city and the police leadership to genuinely recognize that this racial disparity is a serious issue for us. There's been a study going on by the Community Service Council for a decade now on disparate impact of police action on minorities, for juvenile minorities. That study shows consistently for year after year after year that a black youth faced with the same police action that a white youth is faced with is 9 times more likely to see more dire outcomes, jail, longer sentences, those things. Hispanic youth, 7 times more likely than their white counterparts. That's real stuff. I mean, it's not made up numbers. Those are real. If we thought everything was okay right now, by the way, for full disclosure, I'm on the board of the Greenwood Chamber of Commerce. We helped organize these last 2 and the third one coming up of these big community meetings. You're not going to get 300 or 400 black citizens in a room concerned about policing if everything's okay.
Right.
It's just not going to happen, So it's kind of like any other problem. You first have to admit, A, there's a problem. Then you have to do the proper analysis to confirm it. That analysis is mostly done. It's real. And then you have to come up in the community policing model. You come up together with the solutions. But the first solution is in terms of accepting, that there's an issue here.
I want to ask you about gathering of statistics, because there are an awful lot of statistics gathered on this sort of thing. But I'm also reading accounts where, there are some statistics that we're not gathering that we should be gathering. Are we gathering the right statistics now?
There
was a recent study showing that there was not a real disparity between white and black deaths.
That was a study that I haven't had a chance to digest. But what you study is, in terms of disparate impact, is their constant gathering of information over a period of time that says, hey, for example, how many traffic citations a year does the Tulsa Police Department write? Where do they write them, and how many turn signal, broken head tail lights, broken stuff are written by the Tulsa Police Department, and where are they written, and who are they written to? Every time that study is done, it shows that it's disproportionately, those things are done to not only black and Hispanic people, but poor people get the brunt of that, and it's other things you want to count. I did it while I was police chief. I made our officers report and a community report, not just who got shot and who didn't get shot stuff. Every time we had a report of gunfire, every shot, we want to know where shots are being fired, who's firing them. We invest every single way, because the emphasis at the neighborhood level was on things. Well, somebody fired 2 shots and nobody got hit, and so we make a report, we go away. Now, we want to know that, because we want to understand why that happened, because the next shot's going to get somebody and do that thing. So there's all kinds of levels of ongoing gathering of data, but it's not – I led most of the intelligence design after 9/11 for police departments in my work I was doing nationally, and one thing you come to understand about data is it's all garbage unless somebody – is doing an analysis and there's some practical outcomes in terms of applying what you just learned.
Well, let me ask you about these meetings, these community meetings. Do you think there's been any good that's come from them so far?
Well, I don't know. It remains to be seen. I think some has. I think the good that will come out of it, Rich, if it keeps forward, is I think the community, particularly the African-American community. I mean, I've had long conversations with my friend Regina Goodwin, the state representative from North Tulsa. She understands this conversation, and what she is saying and other community leaders, rightly so, is, wait a minute, we've been having this conversation for 25 years. Let's get everybody get up. The government cannot continue, the government also being the police, which are the government, cannot continue to kind of say the right things in meetings and then go back and deliver a different message to the rank and file, to the officers. You can't continue to say we're going to do something and then make 14 excuses why you're not going to do it. It has the opposite effect of trust building and respect building. It builds cynical, a community that becomes cynical and disaffected from you. That's dangerous for the officers and for the community.
What about the sentiment that recently cropped up about the officers themselves feeling like they're under assault?
Well, if on any given day, when I was police officer, I mean, I think it's more intense today because of the number of weapons that are in people's hands than when I was, than 40 years ago when I was a beat officer in Short North Tulsa. But in terms of understanding the 990,000 men and women policing, I know a couple things about them. I know that none of them were drafted into the service against their will. I know that they understood going in that you want to be a first responder, you want to be in the police, then there's risk attached to that. I don't want any police officer injured or killed, and the sense of it is up until this year, those numbers had remained kind of steady in terms of officers being murdered, between 28 and 32 or 33 officers a year. That's 28 or 32 too many, by the way. I don't want to misunderstand, but there are things that have happened in these tragedies, particularly with the assault weapons and things that are raising the ante, and the police leadership, the majority of police leadership has handled it extremely well, in terms of their response to the communities about this, by saying, listen, we understand the risk, we're going to be out there every day, but it's not necessary for you to profess your love for me or my officers every day for us to give you high quality service, for us to risk for you and serve for you. That's not necessary. What is dangerous is when the police begin to overplay the victim's card in these things and say, listen, my job is too dangerous and you don't love me, and therefore I'm somehow going to pull back and not give you the service. Rich, we as human beings, you can't have it both ways. You can't want to be seen as a brave, courageous first responder, as most of our men and women are, and also be seen as frightened and cowering back. You can't have it both ways. I think people are particularly getting tired, particularly our minority communities, of waiting for them to say, okay, we're going to actually act on these things.
All right. Well, Drew Diamond, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks, and my pleasure. Thanks, Rich.
Drew Diamond now is the executive director of the Jewish Federation of Tulsa, but remains a community policing advocate. He was a former FBI agent and former chief of the Tulsa Police. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.